Ira.
Hi, Amy. I'm Ira. I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah.
Welcome back, everybody. Happy New Year. I have one announcement. If I win the lottery tonight, I'm buying a treatment center in a church, and Jerry's going to run it. Okay. And that's all. Everything else I'm keeping, so don't come looking for me. So I get the pleasure of introducing our speaker tonight. Our speaker tonight is Margaret. I met Margaret at a regular Wednesday night meeting that I go to, and it was funny because I'd never known her, but I heard her share, and I said, okay, this is someone who's worked the program, she's in the book, she works with others, she does all the things that we preach and teach. So especially anybody who's new, but to all of us, listen to what Margaret's got to say. She's got a lot of experience, strength, and hope, and she's done it the right way. So with that, I give you Margaret.
Thanks, Eric.
Because I'm an alcoholic, I have to bring my drink. Okay, so I'm Margaret. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is March the 4th, 2009. I have a sponsor, I have a home group, I sponsor people, I go to a bunch of meetings, I've done the 12 steps. And my story is not a story of lots of like really funny consequences or great dysfunction, but it's a pretty run-of-the-mill story of... you know, I grew up in sort of middle America, upstate New York. I was the middle child of three. My parents didn't drink because both of their mothers were alcoholics. So I wasn't beaten. I wasn't abused. I had a pretty uneventful childhood. I was not a particularly traumatized child. I didn't feel left out. And then, you know, sometime in middle school, I decided smoking outside substances was a good idea. Don't really know why. Maybe I kind of was tired of being like a goody two-shoes or something like that. And that outside substance was easy to get in middle school. And then probably end of eighth grade, I had my first drink of alcohol. I don't remember it. But I know by the time I was a freshman in high school, I was the kid who was always looking for the party. I was the kid who... was pretty early on a blackout drinker. I was often the life of the party. I grew up at a time that a lot of you guys won't know about, back when high school kids could drink, so 18-year-old drinking age. So when I was, you know, 14 and 15, the parties that had seniors at them often had parents and kegs of beer. And I grew up in a kind of like Beaver Cleaver community where I think they were more afraid of high school students having sex than drinking. So there was plenty of alcohol. There was probably sex too, but I was too focused on the alcohol. And from the beginning, like, I was pretty good at drinking and getting away with it. I did all the sort of classic stupid things, driving drunk at 16 in the middle of the day. You know, I was the one who... You know, I went to a girls' school with, you know, cute little uniforms. I was probably like the angelic picture, and I was the one who made fake IDs for everybody. I kept getting away with it. You know, I did well in school. I was not isolating from people. I did the whole, like, I'm sleeping over at so-and-so's house when I knew I was going to get wasted. I was a blackout drinker. I may have said that. And I chose the college I was going to go to based on where there was still an 18-year-old drinking age. So I went to school in D.C. where, although they had changed the drinking age for hard alcohol, I could still drink beer and wine. And I drank alcoholically all through college, again with no consequences, but I had already started to change my life. I was not what I called a phone group person, so... At least where I went to school, there were groups of people where, like, five girls had to do everything together. I wasn't one of those girls. I could do anything with any number group of people and basically show up at any party or any group function that might involve alcohol any night of the week, and nobody would know how often I did that, which was more or less every day. I used the credit card that my dad gave me basically for food. You know, I just pick restaurants that sold alcohol and, you know, drinks for my friends. And because it was legal, I didn't get in a lot of trouble. You know, I did pass out a lot. I did a lot of stupid things. But I got away with it. Again, sort of story of my life. Then I started doing the moving around thing. And the whole restless, irritable, discontent thing, I didn't know what that was. But I was very good at being really outgoing and the life of the party in public. But somewhere around 22, 23, I started to describe how I felt inside as frozen. Like, I didn't really feel like I had any feelings. You know, like, I had boyfriends, but I wasn't, like, that whole, like, even the word intimacy, like, when it wasn't a euphemism for sex, just made me cringe. You know, like, I don't really want anyone in my head. You know, nobody needs to be that close to me. And I kept drinking. And, you know, I left the country and I kept drinking. I came back. I went to business school. I met in business school the man that I would end up marrying. And I wouldn't say it was like some phenomenal love match. But in my head, I kind of knew when I was single, I was kind of a mess. I would party too much. I was out of control, and I'm like, okay, this will settle me down. You know, and I like this guy. We have a lot in common. And, you know, I'd read enough history and literature to know that, you know, this romance thing and in love, that was kind of like a, you know, I don't know, silly construct. And, you know, most people really got married for more practical considerations. I'm like, this is a good thing. So I got married. And then, like, a lot of my story, like, goes on from there, doing the things that externally you're supposed to do. You know, I got a good job. I left a good job and started my own company. I wanted to start a family. That didn't work out. And then, you know, after I started a company, I got pregnant right away. And interestingly enough, I did quit drinking. I had two kids. I did quit drinking after I found out that I was pregnant, you know. So I had been drinking pretty alcoholically until I found out. But I credit the pregnancy hormones of, you know, I was able to stop pretty cold turkey. But literally the day I got home from the hospital with both children, I started drinking again, despite the fact that I was breastfeeding, which, not so good. And actually, after my two kids, it just got worse. You know, so I blacked out a lot when I was younger. Sometime in my 20s, I actually stopped having hangovers, which I was like, yes, I am really good at this drinking stuff. Turns out, like, when you have a hangover, that's actually a byproduct of your liver processing the alcohol. And apparently there's something about women's physiology that in some cases it just goes straight into our bloodstream, which is why the same amount of alcohol for, you know, a woman and a man who weigh the same will affect women and men differently. So basically I was just getting alcohol straight into my brain and my bloodstream. So less liver damage, but more sort of brain damage. What's really interesting about this part of my life is when I look back at it, it's all kind of the same. You know, I got married, I had two kids, I started a business, I sold a business. There's like a 15-year stretch that is really like almost indistinguishable, except for those things. And in some cases, I can't really remember those things either, because really what I did was drink and think about drinking. And the people in my lives were actually, dare I say, an annoyance. They were a thing I knew I needed to deal with. They were part of like kind of the keeping the painting on the walls looking right. Like if you've ever read the picture of Dorian Gray, you know, all of that stuff was my picture of Dorian Gray. Look really good outside. You just don't want to see what's in the closet. And what was in the closet, particularly after my second child, We moved because of my job. We moved from California to Charlotte, North Carolina, which was quite a shock for my then husband, who was actually German, and the South, and particularly really sort of small town South, is very different than the Bay Area and very different from Europe. So he was like a fish out of water and kind of miserable. I didn't want to deal with him, so I either worked a lot or I drank. You know, and at the same time, I had two very small children who basically I paid for stuff, but I ignored them. You know, they had a nanny. They had my husband. And they really didn't have a mother who was present. And I used to think about, like, I still have the chair that I would sit in mostly to drink. And I'd be up and out of that chair because there was no glass big enough for me to have enough. You know, so, you know, I'd have two sips out of the glass and then it was not full enough. So I'd be back getting more in the drink. And I'd be sitting there and I would think of myself like in a plexiglass tube that went from the floor almost to the ceiling. And I could see out of it and I could hear a little bit. But really, I was not interacting with anyone. And my tube would go with me to the fridge. But that's what I did. And I worked out, you know, how I could hold down a job, you know, respond to emails while absolutely freaking drunk out of my brain. You know, I knew if it was at all complicated, I can't respond to that. But anything kind of stupid, I could respond to, but then I wouldn't remember if I responded to it. So the next morning, I'd have to look in my sent file to see whether it responded to it. And somewhere in the late 90s, I started having panic attacks and anxiety. I started to shake. My vision started to be effed up. That's as good as I can do on the profanity, sorry. And I didn't want to do anything about it because I didn't want to go to the doctor because I kind of knew what the doctor was going to say if they did any kind of blood work on me because, you know, I didn't, during a work day, start drinking early enough that it would always be in my bloodstream. But if I didn't have work, I couldn't not start drinking. So weekends were really tough for me. The only thing that could keep me from drinking by about 11 a.m. was shopping. That was kind of when I discovered shopping, which I still have that kind of issue. But I lived for 3 years shaking, blurry vision, panic attacks that, you know, until I'd had like maybe half a dozen of them, I really thought I was going to die every time. I actually called the feeling I got in my throat that would constrict my throat, I called it the ick. And when I first started feeling this, it would kind of creep up during the day. But the last 3 years I was drinking, it started when I woke up that my throat was constricted. And the only thing that could make that feeling go away is I put alcohol on my tongue. It didn't even have to hit my bloodstream. It would hit my tongue. My throat would relax. My brain knew relief was coming. Now, I also had read that the alcohol caused the panic and the anxiety. You know, the comorbidity rate is enormous. You know, most people who have panic attacks are also alcoholics. So I knew that these things were related, but and I knew I was an alcoholic. I just thought I was getting away with it. You know, I thought I was managing. You know, I paid the bills. I was the kind of alcoholic who paid the bills more than once. If she blacked out and forgot, I would overpay things. Which might sound like, you know, like, oh, okay, that's a pretty high class problem. But when you have no memory of almost anything, including, you know, did you speak to your children today? You know, did you speak to your husband today? And I basically was living as pretty an isolated shell. I would go to work. I would put on a complete act. And I would come home and be a complete zombie. And I kept living like this. And about 9 months before I got sober, we were on vacation. I'd had a really enormous fight with my husband, and I was completely drunk, shocking. And he left me with the children and the car while we were on vacation. And so I drove the children home. I was just out of my mind drunk. And, you know, I probably had enough kind of soul left that I knew that was horrible and terrible. And I'd driven drunk with them before, but not that bad. You know, how we drive, you know, like... my 7-year-old son started trying to comfort me. And I was freaking floored because I grew up with a mother who was a child of an alcoholic who had told me what her life was like. And, you know, my family's Irish, so there wasn't a whole like, oh, this is a bad person who's an alcoholic. There's kind of a collective group strategy to kind of just keep the lights on, you know, and protect the alcoholic from herself and, you know, from embarrassing the family. So my mom's life as a young person was protecting everybody else from her mother. And that my 7-year-old was trying to take care of his mother somehow like pierced the, you know, the plexiglass tube to a point where I was like, F, you know, like, this is really awful. Like, this, I am my grandmother, and I don't want to be my grandmother. My grandmother, perfectly fine person, but she left quite a mess. And she died she died still an alcoholic after strokes, and, you know, she was an invalid for 17 years and really a miserable person. And, you know, I didn't have this notion that I'm going to go out in a blaze of glory and I'm going to die as a young drunk. Like, I had an image of what I was likely to be, which is an old, miserable, absolutely homebound woman who had to live with basically thieves and drug addicts who would take care of her and steal from her, but buy her alcohol. Like, and this was, a college-educated woman. I mean, it was just really, like, I didn't want to be that person. So somehow that penetrated a little bit, and I thought I needed to do something. So I went to a therapist who told me I wasn't an alcoholic and that I should try some controlled drinking. I told him how much I drank, and I kind of cut it in half, and he said, that's not that much. So he told me, I'd never really heard about controlled drinking because I never really ever thought the point. Like, closest to controlled drinking I ever did was, like, try to drink a glass of water in between drinks at the bar, which that never worked out very well. So I tried the controlled drinking thing for 3 days, and that didn't work out. But I was like, yeah, I'm all right. And then, I don't know, like a month later, somehow I was like, yeah, this isn't good. So I called the employee assistance line, and I got the name of an addiction practice. So I went to see a psychiatrist who prescribed depression and anxiety meds for me, which actually, you know, that was helpful because I'm not sure I could have walked into a room of Alcoholics Anonymous the way I literally shook. Not just from the DTs. I started also seeing a counselor who was talking to me about outpatient treatment, and, you know, I had a lot of really good reasons why I couldn't go to treatment. You know, I was really important. You know, I was really busy, and I was okay, you know, like, it's all right. Which, of course, was not the truth, because... you know, probably about half of the nights I would wake up, you know, asleep in my closet or passed out in my closet, you know, and my husband was sleeping in the guest room. And I would know something bad happened, but I wouldn't know what. Before I learned that, you know, late model cars won't kill you if you leave the ignition running when the garage door closed, I passed out in my car on more than one occasion. And didn't die. You know, I was in a lot of pain, so I took, you know, when I had my 2 C-sections, I had gotten a bunch of Vicodin that I knew I was too addictive to take. So I didn't take as prescribed when I was like doubled over in pain, but I saved them. Yeah. So, and I had a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old. So, you know, I had some pretty old Vicodin. So maybe that's why that didn't kill me. You know, so I was pretty messed up. But then I got laid off. And I didn't get laid off because I was drinking. I got laid off because of the financial crisis. I worked for a bank. And what I did was not something the banks needed done. I did innovation work. And, you know, a lot of people might have said innovation was the problem with the banks, so they really didn't need what I did. So I got laid off, and all of a sudden I had all this free time. And I went on a, you know, I started looking for a job, and of course I was still drinking, and I didn't have anything to do all day. So it was really hard not to start drinking very early in the day. But I was, you know, I was trying to get a job, and I got a job interview in Bentonville, Arkansas, which is where Walmart's headquarters is. And nobody told me that it's in a dry county. So I showed up there, and I had my routine where I'd bring, like, a bottle of wine and, like, I went out to dinner with friends the first night I was there. And then the second night I was there, I went out on a job interview, and no one drank. And I was on a job interview, so, you know, you can't be the only one drinking, so I didn't drink. And I got back to my hotel, and lo and behold, you know, it's like 9 o'clock at night. I'm in Bentonville, Arkansas. You know, I had 2 drinks left. And that was it. And I was too chicken to try to go, like, you know, find a cab in Bentonville, Arkansas, to go looking for alcohol across county line, you know, so I didn't do that. And I didn't die. I hadn't had just 2 drinks since I had been pregnant. By that time, 5 years previous. And I didn't die. And I was actually really kind of shocked. Like, I had 2 drinks and I didn't die. Because part of any time I thought about a solution or recovery, I knew that the panic and the anxiety was related to the alcoholism, but I didn't think I could live, I didn't think I could survive not having alcohol. Like, because without the alcohol, the panic and the anxiety were just overwhelming. And so I really was in that place where I couldn't, you know, I knew this S has to stop. But I didn't know how to do it. And I have a lot of recovering alcoholics in my family. And I have to tell you, like, historically, seeing these people, big book thumping and proselytizing, I didn't want what they had. I did not want. My sister got sober at 19. No thank you very much. I'm going to drink for, you know, 20 more years. So anyway, that was kind of a revelation. And a month after that job interview, I was supposed to come here to Atlanta. I lived in Charlotte at the time. And I was supposed to come here to Atlanta for a job interview that canceled at the last minute. And I didn't wake up that day and say, I'm not going to drink today, because I never did that. I knew I was going to drink. I didn't even play that game. Closest I ever got was, like, this shit's got to stop. Like, I, you know. But I never said, I'm not going to drink today, when I knew I was going to. And I don't know why. I mean, for me, I actually think it was my higher power doing for me what I couldn't do. But a sticky note that had been in my office a month earlier when I had been laid off, that had been actually stuck up on my bulletin board with an AA meeting on it, somehow got in front of my face. Now, because I was laid off, I didn't pack up my office. Like, how that sticky note got in front of my face on that particular day, I don't know. But I went to a noon meeting at it was like chemical dependency center, so it's like a treatment center. And it was a women's meeting, and I went in there, and I was not going to pick up a white chip. I was not going to pick up a white chip. And I don't remember much about the meeting. I do remember the promises. They read the promises. I remember that. And I remember people seemed really happy, and they seemed familiar to me somehow. Like, they could be my aunts or my cousins or, you know, people I went to high school with. And I wasn't going to pick up a white chip. And the second time they offered the white chip, right before they did that, a young woman who maybe was like 28 somebody had driven like 2 hours to give this woman a 5-year chip. And I was like, what? You know, I was 41 years old. And I honestly don't know why I stood up and picked up the white chip when they offered. I didn't know. I thought I'd kind of dodged the bullet because I didn't know they were going to offer it again. And they did. And I remember as I was standing up, I was thinking, like, what have I gotten myself into? Because I also didn't know about the whole relapsing business. Like, I didn't know you could do it that way. So I was kind of like, wow. So I can't explain why I went to that meeting. I cannot explain that to you. That's a tough thing for me to this day, because particularly when I meet people who have a hard time getting into this room, I don't know. I don't have anything to say. How do you get into this room? Because I don't know how I got into this room, and I sure don't know that I could get back here. I don't feel responsible for getting into this room. What I do know is when I got into this room, and at 1 o'clock that afternoon, when I had this white chip in my hand, and I was like, "How the fuck am I not going to drink today?" Like, I had no idea. Like, I hadn't, and in a way, it was probably great that I did not have any clue about how I was going to go from 1 until I went to bed without taking a drink. No clue. And the women said, okay, go to a meeting. Call, you know, here's some phone numbers. Call these people. Here's a book. Read the first 164. I mean, it was like people talking at me. And I didn't even, like, I have a space issue. I don't like people closing in on me. I'm not a hugger. Like, I'm sort of the notorious side hugger. And for whatever reason, none of that bothered me. Like, and I think it was, I was just so tired. I was so tired. And these people seemed to know, like, how to get to the end of the day. And that was the only thing, actually, I cared about at that point. Like, and I didn't know that. I didn't know that going into the room. That was the only thing I cared about, is how do I get to the end of the day without drinking and without dying? And I did, and I'm glad the second meeting I went to was not the first meeting I went to, because that was kind of an S show. But I had seen enough at the first meeting that I was like, okay, I'm going to go to another meeting tomorrow. And because I was unemployed, you know, when they said 90 meetings in 90 days, my first thought was, like, that's impossible. But my second thought was, like, okay. And I, you know, and because I'm, like, competitive, I did, like, 130 meetings in 90 days or whatever. But, like, I didn't know what else to do with myself. And I also think it was helpful. Like, I was really brain damaged the first 30 days. Like, I couldn't really read anything. I couldn't pay attention. Like, you know, I had my big book in the meetings, and I was, like, highlighting things. But, you know, maybe I was writing stuff down. But, like, I really couldn't focus. You know, I do remember a few things. Like, somebody did an over and under on me, and I got really pissed off. And I'm like, F you, I'm going to stay. Like, they were betting that I wasn't going to be able to stay. Like, I didn't deserve my seat because I hadn't lost enough. And there is nothing in this program that says what you need to have to deserve your seat in here. And desire to stop drinking and stay stopped is the only requirement for membership. And I didn't know that when I first got here. I know that now. And I know that it was a freaking miracle that I got here. And, you know, what happened after I got here, I just did what people told me to do. Like, I'm not somebody who just follows directions naturally, but I feel like there was grace in my early experience, and maybe it was because I was exhausted, and maybe because you all seemed really happy, and I hadn't laughed, and I loved the laughter. I went to meetings where people laughed and were funny. And I did all the things newcomers do. I took myself way too seriously. I thought, you know, the responsibility of AA was, like, all riding on my shoulders. All kinds of things. And no one kicked me out. Nobody said, don't come back. You know, and I did the steps. And I didn't have, like, my fourth and fifth steps, I think they were good. I did, you know, overachieving me. I love the resentments thing, because the way my sponsor did it was, like, she's like, just write the resentment and why you have the resentment down, and we'll get to the causes and conditions later. So I was like going at it, you know, I had fun doing that. And it turns out, you know, everything was really just like five or six things. I had the real kind of spiritual experiences after my ninth step. And a lot of my amends are living amends. So the biggest amends that I have are to my children, who, you know, I was the, you know, Mother of the Year award candidate. And my children, when I got sober, were 8 and 5. And can't explain to an 8 and 5-year-old why their mother was emotionally unavailable and would occasionally yell at them when they woke you up in the middle of the night because they were sick, because they were disturbing my sleep, and any number of other things that you can imagine. You know, my transgressions were no worse than anyone else's, but they are not the person that I want to be. And the amazing thing about the ninth step, and it says it in the promises, that we don't forget the past or wish to shut the door on it. And for me, that there's something so rich. It's exactly the things that I did that could be a source of great grief that are actually a motivator for me being the mother I want to be today, or, you know, the ex-wife that I wanted to be when I was not the wife that I could have been. You know, if my, you know, now 15-year-old giant son is awake in the middle of the night vomiting on me, I don't get angry at him. I clean up the sheets. I hug him. I change the bed. I put him back to bed. And sometimes I even have this moment of clarity, like, I get to do this. Like, I get to show up like this. And I'm not going to have that opportunity that much, you know, because he does this in college, which, given his genetic makeup, he's probably going to do that a fair bit in college. I'm not going to get to do that for him. And I divorced a year into the program. I listened to people. They said, you know, you don't know what you want. I went to therapy, went to couples therapy. Divorce. My ex had other issues that meant that I actually had a tougher time dealing with a lot of things in my life after I got sober than before. You know, kind of our deal when we were married was I drank and he did whatever he wanted, which included not working for 8 years. And after we divorced, that, you know, that got hard, and there was a lot of just drama around that. And I got to show up as a person that was a different person, that I didn't have to engage in every battle. I didn't have to let every nasty thing said to me kind of cut me to the core. I got to establish boundaries. I got to do a lot of, like, really crazily healthy things, which, you know, like, emotionally healthy is just not something that I would have predicted for me. Like, when they read the Serenity Prayer and the you know, serenity and the promises, I'm like, that's probably not me. And, like, that one in particular has been amazing because my ex committed suicide last year. And I've been able to show up for his family. He was an only child. I didn't have a great relationship while I was married to his mother, or his cousin, who were the two people who came, and I can do the right thing for my children by not being angry. I could do the right thing for my mother-in-law by enabling her still to have her only relatives now in her life. And, you know, the people in these rooms helped keep me not always sane, but at least sort of on a path that was not a more destructive path. And, you know, if there's anything about my story, like, my story wasn't a classic, like, oh, lots of flames and you know, and then she got sober. It's actually the reverse. Like, you know, I was soulless, frozen, and a zombie. I got sober. I have feelings. I have emotions. I now start to have connections with other human beings. And a lot of stuff had, you know, I've been on, you know, I was unemployed when I got sober. I got laid off 18 months sober. And that actually helped me find a new meeting. Like, there's a high noon meeting, an everyday meeting in Virginia Highlands that I found when I got sober, or when I got laid off. So I've done a lot of things that I couldn't have done the way I was living before. And I live a life that I'm actually paying attention to. Like, I spent Christmas, I went away to England with my two boys, and you know, we did some tourist stuff, but mostly we just, like, hung out in this apartment that I rented, and, like, they played video games, and, like, I colored. I have a, you know, the adult coloring book, and I was with them, and I was just like, I like these kids. These are great kids, and I ignored them, and, like, I am not an emotional person, and, like, right now I'm, like, I'm really full up with the fact that, like, I'm not a rotten mother. I'm not a, you know, I'm not an, I don't even think I need to try to be an A mother, but I'm my kid's mother, and I'm doing the best I can, and, you know, I work with other alcoholics because that helps me remember who I am, that, you know, I'm just like anybody else, and my experience before I got sober might have looked a little different, but if I had kept going, you know, I would have been unemployable. If, you know, my economic situation is not what it was before I got divorced. And, you know, I was unemployed and getting divorced at the same time. I've lived on pure commission for a period of time, or 3 years, actually, where the old me would have been paralyzed with fear of where the money is coming from. And I've been taken care of. And it's not always been the way I wanted. And before I end, I actually want to kind of end with, you know, Ira said a lot of nice things. But this year has been an interesting year for me because I think some of it's been grief and being overwhelmed with the situation with my ex. And some of it might be, you know, there, apparently people of really long-term sobriety say there's a point, you know, somewhere between 5 and 7 years where, like, stuff happens and you kind of, like, get full of yourself or something. I don't know. But, like, I haven't been the best AA this year, you know. And I've found myself in meetings where I'm, like, getting judgy, or, you know, I travel a lot, so I haven't been the best sponsor. And some of my sponsees have left me. Some of them, you know, left because they went back out, but some left because they got somebody who could meet their needs better. You know, I don't go to as many meetings as I did. You know, I still choose to go to a lot of meetings, but because I travel, you know, I don't go to as many. And, you know, so if I were to rate kind of where I am in my program, I'm saying, I prayed on my knees last night for the first time in probably, like, I don't know, 6 months. And I don't know if I'll do it tonight. Because I was having, I don't know, some kind of resistance or something. But something clicked for me. And, you know, I think I wanted all kinds of, like, great spiritual, like, basically drugs. You know, like, the pink cloud for me, a lot of people denigrate it. To me, it's like the physical feeling of connection with my higher power. And that was awesome. You know, that's great. I don't feel that great all the time. I deal with depression. I still have anxiety. You know, my life isn't perfect. But I didn't take a drink today. That's pretty freaking awesome. You know, I keep coming back. I've had egg on my face. You know, I've had resentments. I've had all the kinds of things that just a human being has. But, you know, then somebody asked me to do service work and show up and share my story. So, you know, luckily my muscle memory from when I first got sober says, well, somebody asks you to do something of service, you do it. So I did it. So I'm really glad to be here. I'm really glad to be able to share my story. Hopefully it was of some value, and I will turn the meeting back over. Thanks.